This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. During the next hour, a unique perspective on Iowa's prisons. How is our correction system managing increasing numbers behind bars, especially when nearly a fifth of the prison population is experiencing serious mental illness? We'll ask Iowa's Corrections Director John Baldwin and a prison guard. State Senator Bob Dvorsky, who also works in community corrections, provides insight into financing the prison system and rehabilitating inmates. A woman tells her prison experiences and her current focus on succeeding after prison. Iowa's prisons and the men and women whose lives are affected. It's The Exchange, right after the NPR News. We continue The Exchange now. Dean Borg sitting in for Ben Kiefer. And before beginning our scheduled program on Iowa's prison system, we're going to take a moment to talk with Iowa Governor Chet Culver about the extensive flooding in some eastern Iowa communities over the weekend and more ahead, perhaps, as floodwaters move downstream. Governor Culver, good afternoon. Good afternoon, Governor Culver.
Good afternoon, Dean. Good to be with you.
And I know that you've been in the flood areas this Monday morning. Is what you're seeing prompting any additional state assistance?
Yes. I've actually just finished a three-day swing through the flood-impacted areas. I've been to Lake Delhi twice, Manchester, Maquoketa, Monticello, Anamosa, Hopkinton. We've got very serious concerns. Obviously, our thoughts and prayers are with those homeowners, business owners, farmers who have lost so much, especially near the Lake Delhi area in Delaware County. But we're seeing the effects of that catastrophic breach of the levee structure and the dam structure there all the way down between Delhi and the Mississippi River down to the southeast, and other tributaries are at or near record levels too. So it's a very serious situation, and we are throwing all of the state and federal resources possible at you know this natural disaster once again.
And what are those resources? What's being done now, and what are you intending? What do you want to do?
Well, first of all, Dean, our primary focus has to continue to be on public safety. And so I really commend the local law enforcement officials, the State Highway Patrol, and others for trying to keep people out of harm's way. And that's really the good news in all of this, is we've not lost human life or had significant injuries. And that's going to have to remain our priority for the immediate future, given the fact that some of these rivers have not crested yet. But at the same time, we can quickly move forward on recovery and cleanup, and the Department of Homeland Security is very engaged. I was with the director, Dave Miller, yesterday touring the Delhi area and into Manchester. Today, we've had meetings at 10 o'clock with state agencies up at Lake Delhi, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Transportation, Department of Human Services. They're all engaged in trying to help in many different ways in terms of housing assistance,
Governor,
and that type of thing.
Are you intending to ask for federal help?
Absolutely, Dean. We've had 38 counties now. Starting in June 1st, we've just had nothing but flood-related challenges across the state, and we're now up to 38 counties impacted. So I've already asked for a presidential disaster declaration from previous flood-related challenges, and we'll now add to those and add additional counties to that presidential disaster declaration as soon as we can finish these joint preliminary damage assessments, which are taking place as quickly as possible. It will not take long because the damage is extensive. And the other thing we cannot forget in all this is the damage to our agricultural lands. We've had tens of thousands of acres of loss. I toured a farm this morning just north of Maquoketa, and one farmer there alone has lost 1,700 acres of corns and beans. So I've asked the Farm Service Agency, John Whitaker, the state director, and the county FSA coordinators to start communicating right now with farmers that have lost crop and had significant damage. I've asked John Whitaker, the FSA director, to tour the area, and he agreed to do that on Wednesday in Delaware, Jones, and Jackson County.
Do you expect that former Governor Vilsack, now U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, might be out?
I have certainly reached out to his office to make sure that Secretary Vilsack knows the extent of the damage, and I know that the administration is very concerned. I've also heard already from Secretary Napolitano, who is in charge of FEMA, and I expect to be talking to her this afternoon early. So, yes, we will call on all of the federal resources possible, and we're going to need them. I mean, we have been through, one natural disaster after another, and just when we thought we had seen the worst of it in 2008, we have a catastrophic dam break at Lake Delhi, and the ensuing challenges because of it downstream. And so it's still a very serious situation, and we're doing the best we can to move as quickly as possible to help those that have been impacted. And we're going to save Lake Delhi. We are going to do everything we can to stop the water and rebuild that dam. And perhaps we can, there's some silver lining, Dean. I hope, we can consider anyway looking at a new 21st century, hydroelectric dam that could help our state in terms of our focus on renewable energy and maybe allow those folks living in Delaware County and there at the lake to provide their own power because of the new hydroelectric dam. I mean, we have to put all of these possibilities on the table, and maybe we can somehow, come out of this better than we were before.
That was going to be a question that I had about Lake Delhi Dam, and I was going to ask if you'd support rebuilding that dam because it is privately owned. But from what I hear you saying, you're envisioning something bigger and better.
Absolutely. And yes, I do support, saving Lake Delhi. And that's just an incredible state landmark. It's not unlike Lake Okoboji in the northwest part of the state. Iowa families for generations have spent time there. The dam proper is owned by an association, but that dam also will hopefully qualify for a FEMA nonprofit category, and that was the case in 2008 when they had damage. The road is actually what gave way, and it's a county road X31 that is no longer there. That's the section that was wiped out. The dam itself is still intact. We have engineers looking at the dam now to see if the integrity structurally is still there. But that county road, which is also a farm-to-market road, will likely qualify for FEMA assistance as well. So it's possible we can put this all together in terms of the resources and again, rebuild a better, stronger dam there, and maybe a hydroelectric dam as well.
Governor, thank you so much for spending time with us. It's very insightful to get that update on all that you've seen.
Well, my privilege, Dean, I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak about it here today. And local folks should listen, and we're going to try to keep everyone informed in terms of the programs and the way that people can qualify for them over the next several days. So appreciate the time as well, Dean.
And we deeply appreciate you calling us. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, continuing with the program that we have planned here, and it's a big one. We have John Baldwin, the director of the Iowa Department of Corrections, with us. He's in our Des Moines studio. Bob Dvorsky, state senator, chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, and executive officer in our Community Corrections for Iowa's 6th Judicial District in the Department of Correctional Services. Marty Hathaway will be on the program in just a few minutes. He's a correctional officer at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center at Oakdale. And Sue, a Cedar Rapids resident who is on parole, a former inmate at the Women's Reformatory at Mitchellville, working now at readjusting to society after serving a prison sentence. All of those just ahead. And I'm going to start with Mr. Baldwin in our Des Moines studio. The prison population is going up, Director Baldwin. Why is that?
Well, Dean, I think it is a combination of a variety of things. But first off, you should know that we reached an all-time high on October 3rd of 2007 in 8,940 offenders. And this day we're at 8,533. So long-term, we are under where our high was. What's happened in the last year or so, the population has increased from a low of 8,265 up to that 8,533. And that's a combination of a variety of issues. I think most important, it's highlighted by some of the sentences that were imposed, and it also has to do with some of the parole board conversations about when they release people.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, Director Baldwin, because fewer people are being paroled. Is there a reason for that? And really what I'm getting at there is I know that you work in conjunction, although the parole board doesn't report to you. They report to the executive branch appointed by Governor Culver, who we just heard from.
Right.
But you and the corrections department do provide support for them in getting those records ready to go before the parole board. Might the budget problem, the shortage of staff, be affecting that pipeline for people who are up for parole but not getting before the parole board?
Sure. I think part of the issue is just that some of our counselors were obviously I laid off a lot of counselors, and that was simply because we had no money in the DOC budget. A lot of those have been brought back, and we're pleased by that. And the parole board has done an exceptional job, I think, of trying to get the appropriate people out. Clearly, they lost staff, and so they are, trying to get caught up. And they have done, I think, just an exceptional job. In fact, our count has dropped probably about 60 over the last two or three weeks. But mostly, the prison population is geared to sentencing and the length of sentence that the folks have.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the primary driver of what the prison population is.
Dr. Baldwin, thanks for that. And we're going to be asking others about that prison population. Senator Dvorsky's with us, and he's in charge of the Appropriations Committee. So we'll be asking about that. This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. A short break, and we'll be right back with the program on Iowa's prison population. Dean Borg continuing The Exchange, and we're going to be talking about Iowa's prisons during this entire hour. Bob Dvorsky is with us, state senator, and we just heard from Director Baldwin of the Iowa Correction System about the increasing population and the drop in the number of people who are being paroled. Senator Dvorsky, does that concern you? Make you feel that we've got to do something differently in getting money and staffing to Iowa's prison system?
Well, I don't disagree with the fact that we probably need more staff in the prison system. Unfortunately, this last year we had I believe that the largest drop in revenues maybe in modern history in the state of Iowa. So we had to do something to deal with that, and we've laid off a number of state employees essentially across the board in all departments. And unfortunately, because corrections is like the maybe third largest department, they had substantial people laid off. But we have been able to go back, and because of early retirement and such things, we've been able to refill some of those positions, mm-hmm. and I think they're in a lot better shape. I hate to disagree with my friend, Director Baldwin, but I don't think they're talking about an increase of 134 offenders or 1.9%. I don't think that statistic is significant, and I don't think it really reflects too much other than obviously we do have less staff in the system, and so it takes a little bit longer. But I think the mission, the core mission of corrections is moving in the right direction. I think the return rate to prison has been down the last several years. Recidivism rate and that type of thing. And I think this reflects the evidence-based practices we put in place at Department of Corrections and out in the community-based corrections. So I think substantially the Department of Corrections and CBCs have done a great job the last several years working with within the system. Now, if you talk about longer sentences or whatever, that's on the legislature. We may have increased sentences or made new things, crimes and that type of thing. So I really think it's a really small number. And if you look at historically, as Director Baldwin said, I've been around when we were at close to 9,000 in the population, and now we're down to about 8,500 or something. So I think they've done an outstanding job considering under the circumstances they're in.
I want to hear from Marty Hathaway, who is, if you say, boots on the ground. That's where it happens. You make decisions at the legislature on funding, and you work in corrections as far as rehabilitating offenders who are being released. But Marty Hathaway is a guard at the Iowa Medical Classification Center. Marty, what does overcrowding mean to you? How does it affect your life?
What it means to us inside the prison is that we're double bunked in 32 years that I've been in the system. We've double bunked ourselves.
Now, what does that mean?
What I mean by that is we welded another bed in the same cell where there used to be one inmate. Now there's two. When we fill the cells up at Oakdale, what we do is we set up bunk beds on the unit floor, say, and then we put masking tape around the bunk bed, and we call them their walls, and they can't go past the masking tape unless they ask us. So when we go to when we're into overcrowding, it just backs the whole system up, and it creates a lot of tension, and we don't add any more staff. There's only one correctional officer on those units. So when there's only 30 or 60 inmates, now there's 100 inmates on that same unit.
As you were speaking, in the studio with me is Sue, who I said is a former inmate released earlier this year from the Iowa Women's Prison at Mitchellville. As you said, made some of the descriptions there on what happens in a cell. She was shaking her head yes. Sue, tell us your experience at Mitchellville, and does overcrowding affect a prisoner's life and the way that you are rehabilitated?
As far as Mitchellville, they are very, very crowded. However, when he was speaking at Oakdale, when I was there, we transition from a county to Oakdale, and then we get processed to Mitchellville. And they had exactly that exact same circumstance where we had bunk beds out in the general, what they call the general population area, and there was a masking tape. When we got to Mitchellville, pretty much the only thing that it really affected was longer lines as far as different services and things that they provide. And also it takes longer to get into the treatment facilities and programs that they have there. There's a longer waiting list.
Some might say, though, Sue, this isn't meant to be an amusement park.
Absolutely.
Yes. But as it affects your rehabilitation, that would. And did it affect at all some of the services that you were to receive?
Actually, I think I was one of the very fortunate in the fact that I was able to very quickly get into my treatment and was kind of fast-tracked through that. Pretty much the only times that it really, really affects the prison population is when you get people who are there and just don't want to be there and, mm-hmm. you know.
Director Baldwin, I understand, too, that the number of mentally ill prisoners is sharply increasing. In fact, you have just under a fifth of the prisoners in Iowa's penal system now diagnosed with serious mental illness. How does that affect the way that you administer the prisons?
Well, it certainly has some challenges, but I can tell you that our staff, I think, have done by and large an exceptional job of dealing with the seriously mentally ill. And we have various institutions that we try to place most of the seriously mentally ill, either at Oakdale or at a special unit we built several years ago.
But Oakdale's already overcrowded.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that presents a real special problem because you can't get all that probably need that sort of intensive mental assistance in Oakdale.
Right. Well, the part where the double bunking occurs, as Marty correctly described, is on our reception unit or general population. Most of the units, and Marty can correct me, where the severely mentally ill are housed, are kept at a certain number of folks, because we obviously have to have a certain number of staff to cope with the issues.
Marty, as a guard, do you get special training for dealing with mentally ill prisoners?
The training over the years, Dean, is what happened is like we've gone to this e-learning. It's on computer. And to be quite honest with you, the quality of training, in my opinion, has gone down. I've only had two training sessions this year where a live person has taught me, and I've stood there able to ask questions of that person. Everything is on computer now, in my opinion, the quality of training has gone down.
What kind of mental illness are you seeing there?
A lot of different types of mentally ill. I mean, look at what happened in the 80s. All the mental institutions, the federal funding dried up. And so therefore, they kicked them out in society. And then once they came out in society, the cities and the towns didn't want them there, so that they put them in prisons, and we were left to, deal with them in the prison system.
Mm-hmm. We're going to continue our conversation here and get listeners involved here in just a moment, but we're going to be breaking here just very shortly for a short newscast and then back discussing Iowa's prison system with our guest today, John Baldwin, who directs Iowa's Department of Corrections, Bob Dvorsky, state senator, and also in the correction system and rehabilitation, Marty Hathaway, a guard at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center, Oakdale.
Correctional officer, Dean.
Correctional officer.
Thank you.
Thank you. In fact, I was saying guard, but you're a correctional officer. I'll
yes,
make
sir.
That distinction. And also Sue, a Cedar Rapids resident who is on parole after having been at the women's prison in Mitchellville. I'm Dean Borg. This is The Exchange, and we'll be back in just a moment. I'm Dean Borg, continuing the exchange. We're talking today about Iowa's prisons. We have John Baldwin, who directs the Iowa Department of Corrections, on the line. We have Bob Dvorsky in the studio with us here in Iowa City, state senator and also an executive officer in community corrections. Marty Hathaway, who is a correctional officer at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center at Oakdale. And Sue, a Cedar Rapids resident on parole after having served time at the women's prison in Mitchellville. Senator Dvorsky, we were talking just before the newscast about mental illness in prison, and you have the job of rehabilitating, overseeing the rehabilitation of prisoners after they leave Iowa's prison. Is that increasing mental illness in prison presenting a problem for you or challenge?
I think it, and I think Marty Hathaway is correct. In the 1980s, we sort of deinstitutionalized that, and then we didn't put enough community-based services in place to deal with it. So, unfortunately, the prison system has become sort of the place of last resort for people with mental illness, and you have maybe more people in the prison system that are there because they're mentally ill and not necessarily because they're offenders.
What's
I mean,
the
they
solution?
Obviously have created. They've obviously committed crimes, but
what
was it their mental
illness?
Well, I think we need to do more about determining. You know, if you have people who are actual, lack of a better term, convicts who are actually committed crimes, and mental illness was just secondary, or because of the mental illness, people committed crimes. So we need to kind of determine that. The other thing is we have been trying to move some things forward here. The last several years, we were able to get funding for a facility in Cedar Rapids, a community-based corrections for mental illness, the Anchor Center. And we were going to have 24 beds there for inpatient and then all outpatient services. Unfortunately, because of the drop in the revenues, we haven't been able to do any of the inpatient services. But you are doing outpatient services out of there, and that's working with people in the community with mental illness. So that's a good start there. Also, within the prison system, I know Dr. Cellini and some other doctors from the University of Iowa have been working on various things with mental illness in the prison system. And you cited the statistics of about 20%. I think it's closer to 40% in the prison system. And you have maybe dual diagnosis systems also where you have people with substance abuse and mental illness. So it's an enormous problem, and I think that we're trying to get a handle on it and trying to move forward with it.
And that's a legislative job too, isn't it? I mean, the
sure.
money has to come there. Sure, you'll get the experts on what needs to be done, but 40%, that's twice the number that I cited.
You could check with Director Baldwin on that.
Is that right, Director Baldwin?
Well, actually, you are both right. And let me explain that. I understood the question to be what percentage was seriously mentally ill, and if that's the case, then it is 20%. If you're talking about mentally ill overall, that is 40%, and the women are actually 60%. Of the female population have a diagnosable mental illness, and 40% of the entire population has a diagnosable mental illness. Of that number, 20% are what's classified as SMI or seriously mentally ill.
How does that affect the way that you operate Iowa's correctional system?
Well, it certainly has been a challenge to the staff, and the staff, as I said earlier, have almost without exception been very, very good. The issue is there are most mentally ill people in the prison system comprehend their charge, clearly understand right from wrong, and can function very normally in any type of setting.
But it seems to me, from what I'm hearing here, you're administering more of a mental health correctional system than you are a prison rehabilitation system.
Well, we think we have to do both. We, as Bob talked about earlier, our recidivism rates are some of the nation's best. We are a completely evidence-based practice state, which means we only fund programs that have proven positive results for the offenders.
I'm going to ask Sue here in the studio, because she was shaking her head yes at many of the things that have been said here, particularly the number of mentally ill prisoners. Sue, how did that affect your life and your attempt to go straight, go before the parole board and be released? But how did that affect how you succeeded at that?
Well, really, it didn't affect me per se, other than just the interaction that I had with people that were mentally challenged and facing those difficulties while I was in prison. The majority of resources, just from my perspective, you know, it would take more time, more, I would assume, labor intensive to be involved with the people that are facing those difficulties, as opposed to, I hate to say the rest of us, but those of us who don't suffer from those same challenges.
What would you like Senator Dvorsky and Director Baldwin to know about being in prison? What do you think you know that they don't?
Really, other than the fact that I don't know how you would change it, but for the most part, prison in Mitchellville, the part that I was a part of, you know, the guard correctional officers really do a fantastic job. I just think it's the resources, the funding. While I was there, one of my counselor actually did leave, and it was right before I met or was going up in front of the parole board. And that, you know, obviously caused anxiety because I was kind of in limbo there, if you will. So
I think listeners would like to know, how long did you serve at Mitchellville?
I was at Mitchellville for 4 months.
And on what sort of a charge?
Forgery.
I see. Senator Dvorsky, you also wanted to get a word in here.
Sure. I think the situation isn't one where we don't understand that there's mental illness situations in the prison system, or we don't have ideas on how to combat that. I think it's really resources. I served 13 years on the Justice System Appropriations Subcommittee, and if you've served a little time on there, you understand the system and what we're doing. And I think we know what we need to do. We just don't have the resources to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the challenge. And I think Marty would agree with that, as well as Director Baldwin, that's where we're at. And that's the challenge. And I think the more education we talk about this and the more enlightenment there is about mental illness in the state, the better off we're all going to be.
We have more to talk about here than we have time, but I'm going to ask listeners also to get involved, because I think we've raised many, many questions here. The number to call is 1-866-780-9100. Again, 1-866-780-9100. Or you can email a question to theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. I'd like to ask Marty Hathaway, who's the correctional officer. Marty, how has what we've been speaking of here, and that is and you're at the Medical Classification Center, where you have probably the most serious mentally ill cases, but how does that affect a correctional officer's life and their own safety?
It's very unpredictable. I mean, we just had a case this weekend, an officer sitting at his desk doing some paperwork, and a mentally ill inmate came up and just whacked him upside the head with his fist twice. You know, it's very challenging working with these people, especially, you know, since our union asked me, stepped up to the plate and took some mud days, took a mud week, each of us took off to help the state get through this difficult time.
We must say that MUD is an acronym for mandatory time off, isn't that right?
That's right. That's right. We took a week off without pay to help the state get through the financial crisis. And when we did that, we did not replace anybody. And so, you know, it just put a more of a burden on the whole system. And we did our thing, but we were proud to do that. Our members voted on that, and we did that, unlike the counselors did. But it is a very challenging to work with these mentally ill inmates.
Director Baldwin, I'm going to turn to the percentage, the growing number of women inmates.
Yes.
Do the rehabilitation needs of women inmates differ from men in prison?
Absolutely. In fact, we are spending a lot of money rebuilding Mitchellville. And there was a groundbreaking about a week and a half ago out there.
But what's different? What's different about getting a woman ready to go and be released back into the community than
sure.
It is for a man?
Women learn much more in social environments than men do. The relationships with women are way more important than men are. And how we approach both of those, we used to classify people just exactly alike, and that just didn't work out very well. So we have a separate classification system now for the male and the female offender, and we think programs focusing on how to be independent and how to interact socially are just wildly important to the success of our female offender population.
I'm going to bring one of our listeners on the line. Julie Ann is calling from Waterloo. Julie?
Yes.
Your question.
My question, since I have spent time there, is... And
spent
I do
time
have
at
a,
Mitchellville?
Yes, I did. 1 year. I have a serious mental injury or mental illness, and what I saw was a serious lack of support while at Mitchellville. As an example, there was an AA group for Alcohol Anonymous. There was a narcotics group. There was no support group for mental illness. Fortunately, I have good medical insurance. I have wonderful medical staff here in terms of counseling, psychiatry, proper medications, and
but
a lot of...
But what you're saying, Julianne, you didn't get that while you were at Mitchellville, is that right?
No, I didn't. I was only able to meet with a psychiatrist once.
Let me move on to Director Baldwin. Director Baldwin, what about that?
It depends on when she came through the system, but all that could be absolutely true. We, part of the new design of our prison features a huge commitment of state resources to mental health, medical health of the offender population. In our new staffing package for the new ICIW, we include psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers trying to focus on the mental and physical health of the female offender. So we recognize that problem, and we are aggressively addressing it.
Senator Dvorsky?
One of the legislative issues that's combined with this is mental health parity. We've been trying to work on that for several years, and I'm truly convinced that if we had mental health parity, that would really keep a lot of people out of the system.
And what does that mean?
It means your insurance would cover mental illness situations and substance abuse situations.
And that's
if we had, we don't have that right now in Iowa. If we had that in place, I think you'd see fewer people fall in the correctional system because they fall off their meds and they aren't able to hang on to that. And I think that would help us a lot.
And that's what Julianne is saying now. She has support.
She has it now. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Julianne, for calling from Waterloo. I'm going to move on to Pete, who's calling from Cedar Rapids. Pete, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I wondered if we're going to move to a model that's being used in Minnesota. The author of a book called 7 Weeks to Sobriety is Joan Matthews Larson. She's a PhD. She works with a medical doctor. They use nutritional therapy rather than conventional counseling for alcohol and drug addiction. And the reason I ask is I have had several neighbors who have had to cycle through treatment centers and county jail, not the prison systems.
Pete,
yet,
I think we have the gist of your question. Director Baldwin, I think that probably falls into your realm.
Sure. I am unaware of that particular opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Pete, for calling. Jim is calling from Dubuque. Jim, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for the gentleman concerning the successful lowering of the prisoners' return to prison rate. You say that's improving. Could the gentleman comment about the faith-based, private-funded rehabilitation programs that have been available in Iowa? I don't believe they are anymore. And if they would comment as to those faith-based programs help in the success of this lowering of the prisoners' rate coming back into the system.
Jim, thank you for that question. Senator Dvorsky, who works in corrections after prisons are released, has some comment on that, I think.
I think any type of program like that, and it doesn't even have to be faith-based, I think if you put more emphasis and you work with people individually and you have more staff working with them and you have an evidence-based program that you're working with, it's going to work. And that's been proven certainly in the 6th District, a number of the programs that we're offering in other districts across the state. So I think those same principles, if they're applied, they will work if it's faith-based or not. I think that there are a number of programs, but we just need the resources to have the programs and offer those.
Director Baldwin, I'm going to open another subject here, and that is sentencing reform. Do you think that more prisoners are coming into the correctional system than need be because judges' hands are tied, or maybe for longer sentences because judges don't have the discretion? It's already written into law what the sentence will be.
Right. Honestly, do not get involved in that simply because...
simply because it's politics.
Well, yes, and we are only the keepers of those who are sent to us. And we think that's an important distinction for folks to understand. We keep those who are legally charged to us.
We'll turn to the politician then, Senator Dvorsky.
We still have some mandatory minimums in place right now, and there has been a sentencing study that's shared by Senator Cryman and Representative Swaim, and that's not complete yet. But I think we need to look at those mandatory minimums and see if those are really necessary this time and place. And also, I think that we need to make sure that the judges have as much discretion as possible. We have a very good judicial system in the state of Iowa, and we all let them do their work.
Do you think – I know that we're talking to you as chair of the Appropriations Committee and not the Judiciary Committee – but do you think that with the recent Supreme Court decision regarding juvenile sentences for life, that will be taken up by the Iowa legislature?
Oh, I think that Senator Cryman and Representative Swaim are looking at that. And I haven't studied it, so I don't really want to comment, but I'm sure they're looking at it, and we'll see what they'll probably have an analysis and some information on that during the session.
Director Baldwin, any comments on the mandatory life sentences for juveniles not being overturned now by the U.S. Supreme Court?
No, sir.
Okay. I'm going to move on then and ask you, Director Baldwin, as new prison space, maximum security prison at Fort Madison, men's mm-hmm. penitentiary, new wing now at the women's prison at Mitchellville, how is that going to change the management of the correctional system?
Well, it's actually going to allow us to put offenders more in line with where they classify. We're going to house all of our maximums in one, maybe two locations, all of our mediums, and then all of our minimum folks. We will put the right offender in the right place so they can get the appropriate treatment, to go back to what Senator Dvorsky first talked about, so we can offer programs that are evidence-based, that we can get them out and hopefully reduce Iowa's already low recidivism rate, because that's just so important. We keep people from coming back into the system. And that's why we have community-based corrections and the prison. And in Iowa, they both work so well. I'm just certain we're going to have a very strong impact on our recidivism rate.
How will that affect how you rely, though, on community-based corrections? It seems to me you try now, because of the overcrowding, and to get people out into community corrections very rapidly. Right. Is that going to change?
No. I think it'll probably increase the issue of trying to move people down the corrections continuum as reasonably as we can. That people should give a chance to go back to their community and be successful. And I think that's what we're all trying for, both in community-based corrections part of our system and the institution part of our system.
Marty, I'm going to give you a chance here, too, to comment. If you could change Iowa's prison system, what would you say is the number one priority?
Staffing. Put more staff there. There's less staff today. Dean, even with this early retirement, you've had a lot of people go out the door with a lot of experience. You know, that's a good thing that we've allowed people to retire with some dignity, but we've lost a lot of experience, and we need the staffing.
And what do you say? You'd like how many more officers?
We did a study at one time along with the department, and it called for several hundred. More officers.
Now, Senator Dvorsky, is that even in the cards?
It probably isn't in the cards, but I certainly agree with Marty that we do need more staffing and working on that. One of the things that I'm glad Sue is here, one of the things we've been working on, another thread that's going through corrections statewide and nationally now, is reentry. And the idea that if you have some supports back in your community, you can do better. Maybe Sue can comment on that.
What sort of support are you getting right now?
Actually, I have a phenomenal relationship with my parole officer. She, treats me with respect and gives me every opportunity to do the best that I can and to prove myself. To take that a step further, they have what they call WOCOM, which is actually specifically engineered for women and provides it's a board or a panel, if you will, of professionals from different services. housing, medical needs that you may have. And I think the most important thing to get across to people is that if you walk out of the gates with the intention of doing the right thing, there is ample resources in the community through corrections if you take advantage of it.
So you've been happy with the time that you have had outside prison.
Absolutely.
And it's going to increase your chances of succeeding?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to school, I understand.
Not yet.
But you will be.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Director Baldwin, could you go back to the Iowa legislature now, this session? Mm-hmm. What are you going to ask for? You have a new prison being built at Fort Madison. You have a new wing at Mitchellville. What's the next priority? You're going to be asking for something. I know that.
We're going to focus on several issues. Obviously, staff. That's obviously our big issue. We're also bringing online three community-based corrections residential issues in FY12. And we're going to start some of the funding requests for ISP and Mitchellville. And we're going to keep plugging the reentry, which is so important to us. Iowa has a very unique approach. We are a community-based corrections and prison state. And I think we're going to push for programs that support that fact.
What's the number one thing that keeps you awake at night right now?
Staffing.
I'm sure that Marty Hathaway is happy to hear that. Thank you, Director Baldwin. We've been talking with John Baldwin, who directs Iowa's correction system, Bob Dvorsky, state senator, Marty Hathaway, a correctional officer at Oakdale, and Sue, a person who's on parole. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio. Our producer today was Catherine Perkins. I'm Dean Borg. Thanks for listening.